Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The digital world, computers, a part of most of our lives, whether we know it or not. You may not own a computer, but computers help run our cars, withdraw money from bank accounts at ATMs, check out at the supermarket. What if the digital world suddenly flatlined to the point where computers failed even for a short time? Cars would stop, bank records would be lost, military equipment would be rendered useless. Around the world, computer hackers have proven the digital world's vulnerabilities time and time again and on many levels. Today, business, industry, and government are turning to security specialist hackers to help make them more secure by protecting their products and secrets from remote intruders. One of the very best is a St. Louisan who holds a Ph.D. in mathematics from Notre Dame. His name is Charlie Miller, and he joins us in studio. Charlie, nice to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you prefer the term hacker or cyber research specialist?
I don't mind hacker. A lot of people in my field like to be called security researchers just to differentiate ourselves from the bad guys.
Right. There's black hackers and white hackers from what I understand.
Yeah, black hat and white hat, yes.
Yeah, right. Okay. Tell us, if you will, the Cliff Notes version of your path from the start of all of this life of yours to where you are today.
Sure. So I went to school, and my PhD is in math, which isn't exactly what I use now. So when you get a PhD, there's not too much you can do. You can become a professor or, you know, maybe work at Starbucks. I don't know. But the option I took was I went to work for the National Security Agency, and they hired me to be a cryptographer to write codes and break codes and that sort of thing. But I was sort of sick of math at that point. Yeah. And they had a training program for computer security there, and I took that and spent 5 years there learning the craft. And since then, I've been doing research and working as a consultant, and now I work at Twitter.
This is really a burgeoning field, is it not? This the white hat hackers working in security.
Yeah, it's important. You know, we rely on computers all the time, and we sort of take for granted that when we, you know, our bank account's going to still have the same amount it did yesterday. And if that's not the case, then, you know, we're very concerned.
Right. I want to go back to the NSA. I will appreciate the fact that you're probably going to say you can't talk very
much
about it. But I suspect you are reading and watching with interest what's going on now with regard to this data mining process. What are your thoughts about it?
So it's interesting. When I worked at the NSA, it was 2000 to 2005. They told us very explicitly that the NSA does not spy on Americans. And, you know, we certainly believed them, and I did. And we took classes every year to remind us about the laws and how we didn't do that. And now it seems that that's not the case. And actually, if you look back, it seems that even when I was there that this was going on. So it's pretty frightening to think that, you know, while I was there, they were telling us we don't spy on Americans, but I guess we do.
Is it frightening in another regard, that being that they have access to an awful lot of information?
Well, they have a lot of smart people, and they have a lot of equipment, a lot of money, and you know, unlimited resources, essentially, to do their job. Right. So you don't want to be on the receiving end of that.
How deep can they peel the onion when it comes to this meta information they're coming up with? Telephone numbers, on calling numbers, and receiving numbers. How deep can they take that if they wanted to?
Well, you know, you call your friends and your friends call their friends, and it's a lot of information. But if you have enough computing power, you can figure out, you know, everyone's connected, right? You know, this whole Kevin Bacon game.
6 degrees of separation.
Right. And so you imagine that you can be connected to someone pretty quickly, and it's not hard to do the crunch numbers and figure out, you know, a lot about your life with that information.
Such as, I mean, how, again, what are the kinds of things that if they wanted to, they could do?
I mean, this is just speculation at this point. I haven't worked there in
Sure, no, I get it, but you do know the capability of the technology.
To some extent. So, I mean, think about the types of things that you probably don't want people to know. So, how often do you visit the doctor? What specialists do you see? You know, where does your kid go to school? How often does you have to talk to your wife, or, you know, how often do you frequent hotels? You know, there's a lot of information that you sort of take for granted out there that you probably don't want people to know about.
Do you have concerns about Fourth Amendment issues and privacy issues?
Oh, certainly. I have huge concerns about that. And I've more or less given up that there isn't much privacy on the internet, or when you use your phone, or your GPS location, any of that. And so one of the things I really would love to work towards is building technologies that everyone could use that would protect us, you know, through strong encryption and that sort of thing.
Of course, the lack of privacy these days is really self-imposed. I mean, people are putting everything they know about themselves on Facebook, and you're working for Twitter now.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. So people don't seem to be too concerned about some of these things.
Well, people probably should be a little more concerned for one thing. But the other thing is there's, you know, when you post to Facebook, you know you're posting to Facebook, and you're doing that with the expectation that people are going to see it. But if you want to know, you know, who your best friend is or who you're calling the most, like that's sort of information you probably aren't intending to share.
But people can get at that, obviously, and learn more about you than you may even realize that you're letting them know.
Sure, definitely. Sure.
About Twitter. You're employed by this company. You probably can't say much. But what are the kinds of things that Twitter would be concerned about? This is a different animal.
So at Twitter, my job is to make sure that hackers don't break into Twitter and steal your personal information. So Twitter is concerned with for example, I send direct messages to my friends, and this is not public. And Twitter doesn't want people to break in and steal that information.
Haven't there been some issues recently with Twitter in that regard?
No, as far as I know. So, there was a small incident about a year ago, but luckily not too much came of that.
Yeah. I wonder how many, you probably don't know specifically the answer, but how many companies these days are employing people like you?
I would think that most large companies do, and those that don't probably at least hire consultants like me. So I spent most of my career working for consulting companies. I mean, sometimes it doesn't make sense to hire someone like me to work full time, you know, if you maybe only need it for a couple weeks a year. So there's a lot of people in my field who are consultants, and you hire them for a month or 2 months or whatever.
How vulnerable are we as a society to people who have evil intentions, more beyond just plain mischief when it comes to hacking? And we'll take that up the ladder to internationally and some of the things we're hearing about. How vulnerable are we?
Right. A lot of it depends on who the attacker is. So if it's, you know, some teenagers, that's one thing. If it's maybe cyber criminals trying to make money, that's another thing. And then if it's, say, China or Russia or some nation state, that's a whole other thing. So if you look back at, you know, just people who are sort of interested in showing off, or the sort of the old school traditional kind of hackers, you know, teenagers from Eastern Europe or whatever, most of us probably aren't too vulnerable to that. You know, we've evolved the security of our computers a lot in the last 10 years. But when it comes to, you know, people with resources and people who are dedicated and don't give up easy and are trying to make money, like then it's a little easier to fall prey to them.
My wife said the other day when I mentioned that we were going to be doing this program, she said, is it possible that a 12-year-old in Oshkosh could bring down the power grid, that could start World War III?
Hopefully not a 12-year-old, but I don't know too much about SCADA is the term used for the industrial control systems. I don't know too much about their security, but every indication is that it's not as strong as it needs to be.
So that's where people like yourself come in. If you were called in to deal with something like this, how would you go about it? What is the process? You sit down in front of a computer, then what?
Well, every system is different. So you would have to look at it, and the first thing you would have to do is determine where attacks could come from. So we call this the attack surface. So for something like a power station, you would say, where can an attacker come from? Is anything connected to the internet? Are the systems that are connected to the internet connected to the sensitive systems we care about? And, you know, how are they connected? And basically just start from the outside and work your way in. And then, you know, conversely, start on the inside and see, you know, at the most sensitive things, how can data possibly get out of there or into there?
And then what?
And then you look for, you know, known vulnerabilities in those systems. And beyond that, you start to look for, you know, search for vulnerabilities no one's known about yet.
When we're talking about a vulnerability, maybe for people who aren't as close to this as you are.
Your listeners aren't all hackers?
Not that I know of. Let's define vulnerabilities in this case. What are we really talking about?
Sure. So vulnerability is a problem, a bug in software, say, or even in hardware that would allow an attacker to do something. So maybe your web browser has a vulnerability that would allow an attacker that when you visit a certain web page to download code and run it on your computer. So vulnerability is sort of the door that lets people get in. And this is the reason why your computer is constantly updating itself. Every time it'll be like, oh, Windows wants to update. This is because people found vulnerabilities and they need to fix those vulnerabilities.
But that's like locking the barn door after the horse is gone, isn't it?
Sometimes, and that's the whole thing. So, you know, like I said before, there's known vulnerabilities, things we know about, and then there's the unknown ones. And those are the scary ones because we can patch the known things, and we're not even really good at doing that. But then there's all the ones that we don't know about. And just because you and I don't know about a particular vulnerability doesn't mean the 12-year-old kid in Oshkosh hasn't figured it out. So,
when you talk about patching, what exactly are you saying?
So patching is like, again, going back to the example of your web browser. You know, so there's going to be – it was written with some code and it processes web pages and shows them to you. And sometimes it doesn't do that correctly. And if it really messes up, it'll, like I said, it lets the bad guy do something to you. So what a patch does is it fixes that problem. So maybe the programmer who wrote that assumed something that wasn't necessarily true. And so the patch just goes in and fixes that particular bug so that the bad guy can't take advantage of that anymore.
Is there a particular web browser that is less vulnerable than others? We've got Internet Explorer, Chrome, Firefox.
Right. They're all, you know, they're all better than they were 5 years ago. But probably Chrome is the strongest browser just because of Google has really spent a lot of time making it secure. It's one of the advantages it also has is one of the last ones developed. And so something like Internet Explorer was initially developed maybe, you know, I don't know, 10 or more years ago.
Yeah.
And we didn't really understand security then, where Chrome was written, you know, basically with security in mind from the ground up.
What do you run?
I don't know if I should tell you, but I actually run Safari because I like Apple and Mac products, and I figure I should use what they tell me to use.
And you're feeling pretty secure with that, obviously.
Not entirely, but, you know, like I said, so there's I'm pretty secure, feel good about the known things, but there's always the unknown vulnerabilities that I don't know about, but someone else might.
Can you fix that yourself? If you're at home and you see a problem, your various virus contaminations, can you just deal with that yourself?
So if I find a vulnerability in, say, in Safari, which I have done many times, I can fix it, but it's pointless to do that. The easier thing to do is to contact Apple and tell them about it and wait for them to fix it.
Are these antivirus programs out there that you can download for nothing any good?
They're okay. So there's – I mean, all the antivirus programs are just okay. So, I mean, the problem is that most of them work by – they know to look for particular things. But if you're a bad guy and you know exactly what they're looking for, then you can design your malicious code to not look like that. So if you know, it's just it's a race to the bottom, and whoever, if you want to get around antivirus, you can. If you're too lazy, then antivirus works.
And that can be a real problem down the line.
Sure.
Our guest is Charlie Miller. He is a professional hacker. He doesn't mind that term, but he doesn't mind being called a cybersecurity researcher either. He's from St. Louis. He's doing work now for Twitter, but he's done it for many, many other organizations and companies too over the years. We'll come back and continue our conversation about this business of hacking in general. We're all vulnerable to it one way or another. We'll get more specific when we come back. And we'd like to get you into the conversation as well. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. Send us a tweet at STL on Air. Back in just a moment with Charlie Miller. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with Charlie Miller, the hacker, the cybersecurity researcher, who's working for Twitter these days, but as I indicated earlier, has worked for a number of other organizations over the years. We want to bring you into the conversation, so give us a call after I give you some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. The Missouri Farm Bureau is weighing in on the Farm Bill. The Illinois State Police are announcing the results of a major drug bust in the Metro East. And also in the Metro East, there is a closure planned this weekend of eastbound I-55/70/64. These stories and more this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Charlie Miller. Are we behind other nations, do you think, in this whole field of protecting what we want to protect?
I don't think it's that we're behind. The bigger problem is that we are the most dependent on technology of any country. So if you consider maybe terrorists in Pakistan or North Korea or something. So if you consider if the entire internet just went away for a couple of days, those groups wouldn't care. They don't use the internet. They don't depend on it. But for us, it would be a huge shock to everything we do, and I'm sure our economy would suffer from it. So I think everyone no one really knows how to defend at this point. I think a lot of countries are good at attacking. So we don't know how to defend, and the problem with us is that we are the ones who sort of rely on it the most, and so that makes us the most vulnerable.
I get the impression from what I read that China is as active or perhaps more active than anybody else in this area.
Well, if you listen to the U.S., that's certainly what we say. So we get mad that they attack us. And I think the thing that the U.S. government gets really upset about with China is that China, if you believe what is said, attack not only, say, our government computers, but also corporations. And they use that information, this trade secret information, to help the Chinese corporations. And so I think the U.S. is probably okay if countries are sort of attacking each other's governments, but they don't like the interference with the free market.
Well, I would have to assume that we're doing the same thing.
I think that's probably a fair assumption, although I don't think the U.S. really comes out and says that.
No, I'm certain that that's not the case. Very difficult to protect against. I mean, a couple of months ago, I guess we were talking about a building in Beijing that they had identified as the place where all these attacks were coming from.
Right.
Still can't do anything about it.
Yeah. It's interesting because if you're worried about a conventional army, you just line your tanks up at the border and your airplanes, and eventually the enemy's got to go past there. But with cyber attacks, the packets are flying and you want to communicate with other countries. I want to be able to go to a Chinese website, I guess. And certainly we want the Chinese to come to our websites. And so it's not the same. You can't easily distinguish the friendlies from the enemies.
I've also heard it said that the next major battlefield, world battlefield, will be a cyber battlefield. That's why send people out when you can essentially destroy a society through hacking?
I think that as soon as a country thinks that their society is about to be destroyed by hacking, they're going to send in the soldiers. So I don't think we're going to see exclusively a cyber war.
But how would you know? I mean, until it happens, you don't know, do you?
Well, even if the power grid would go away, you could still, have fuel for your airplanes and your tanks, so you can drive them in. Yeah, I think probably any future war will definitely contain a cyber component.
The Stuxnet system, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, received a lot of publicity in the not-too-distant past. This is the program. It's been claimed that either we're doing it or the Israelis are doing it, and that is disrupting Iran's nuclear capability and nuclear development capability. Any thoughts about that and the way this is used?
Right. So this was an interesting piece of malware because it was incredibly sophisticated. So we talked earlier about known vulnerabilities and unknown vulnerabilities. It contained like five or six exploits that took advantage of these unknown vulnerabilities. So took a lot of effort and research to get it to work. And that also meant that even if the systems that were attacked were completely up to date, completely patched, ran all the best security, this thing still worked. And not only that, it actually made physical changes. So it wasn't just it could steal your pictures from your computer. It was actually changing the way that the equipment was working in Iran.
This is never going to change, and it's only going to become more sophisticated.
Yeah. And then one other interesting thing about that was the Iranians aren't stupid. They did not have their systems connected to the internet. So the only way that this attack would work is if we had a person walk into the facility and infect a machine inside there. So, the most advanced cyber attacks still rely on, a guy in a janitor suit or something.
Or someone infecting someone's laptop who worked in the, without them knowing it, who worked in the facility, and they go in and hook it up and bingo,
right.
The infection happens.
Yeah, I'm not sure if they ever figured out exactly how it got started, but it definitely wasn't over the internet. So it was very advanced and sophisticated.
Lots more to talk about with Charlie Miller, but we have a lot of phone calls. Let's bring the audience into this discussion. We'll start with James calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, James.
Hi. Glad to hear that you're talking about hackers. I have a Mac. It's a 2008. It crashed in November of 2012. One of the people working in the service place put in Microsoft Office 2011, and I did not realize that he could control. There's a thing called the administration. Keychains, systems preference, and Safari. There were about 10 people said they erased everything, but this person seems to have hidden in the proprietary parts of the Mac his stuff, and he always came back up, and I talked to 20 of the senior technical advisors throughout the United States and Canada, and they did not or would not or could not fix it. Could I have your number so I can...
You sound like the rest of my family wanting my my tech support skills. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what about your case. Macs typically are reasonably secure compared to a PC, at least in normal usage. I'm not sure exactly what happened to your system.
What he's doing is using, like I said, Microsoft, and in systems, in library, in documents, when people said that they have erased the entire system and it started over, they didn't, because the machine was still vulnerable. And I know of Jack's dad who started Twitter, which is sort of interesting. His dad lived in the same neighborhood. So do you have a number or a group that I could call to discuss this situation?
Maybe if you don't choose to give your number, Charlie, you could is there someone you could refer him to, or some place you could refer him to for the answer to his question?
I mean, probably the best advice is just to take it to the Genius Bar, the Apple Genius Bar. Those guys are probably better at tech support than I am.
Okay, James, good luck with you on that problem. Thanks for calling. Let's bring in Zach. He's calling from Union. Go ahead, Zach.
Hey, hi. Is there any benefit to your computer with streaming versus downloading stuff onto your computer? That's my question.
There's no, from a security perspective, it doesn't matter. If there might be some other reasons why you would want to do one or the other, but if you're just worried about hackers, you're equally vulnerable either way.
Thanks for the call. Nick in West Virginia, a long distance call from Nick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
North Virginia, actually. And I'm an old friend of Charlie's, and I want him to talk about something other than tech support questions. So here's my question. Charlie, you recently were in Vegas at Black Hat DEF CON, and I wanted you to maybe talk about the hacker culture within Las Vegas at these hacker conferences. We're not all just overweight people living in our parents' basements now, are we? And you are a prime example of this.
Oh, yeah, so I know Nick. Yeah, I'm not fat, and I don't live in my parents' basement, but I'm still pretty nerdy and geeky compared to the average guy. But yeah, as far as hacker culture goes, my wife is a sociologist, and she sort of wanted to study this at one point. And I told her there is no hacker culture. It's like we just hang out and talk security and, hang out at bars or whatever. And she said I just didn't know because I was part of it. And since then, I've been paying a lot of attention to it. And I think she's right that, we're all sort of interested in technology and what it can do, and we want to play with it, we want to understand it, and we don't want there to be limits to that sort of thing, and we share that common bond, I think.
All right, Nick.
Perfect.
All right. Thanks so much for the call. Thanks for joining us. Let's call in Sheila from Richmond Heights. Go ahead, Sheila.
You are a St. Louis treasure. I have been wanting to meet you for so long. I hope you write a book, do some public appearances. Business is so fascinating, but it's so frustrating to think that you can work so hard and then have someone hack you. I mean, you know, how do you use risk management? I mean, it's terrifying to work so hard and have things just fall apart because of a hacker.
Well, it is scary, but I think it's not as different as you might think. So if you think back maybe like the Old West or something, people out there in their homesteads, they would work hard and, you know, some criminal might just come in and take it all away. And I think that we're sort of in the same with computers, as you work hard and you're still vulnerable. And even me, you know, I know what I'm doing, but I don't think that I can't be attacked and that I'm not as vulnerable as anyone else. So it's scary, but all you can do is, you know, hope for the best and do the, you know, prepare and, you know, you back up your stuff and take precautions as much as you can and just enjoy the technology.
We are probably, in this world, we are probably about where the automobile was in 1920, wouldn't you say? I mean, we're really taking the first steps.
Right. And as, 10 years ago especially, we had no idea what we were doing. Now we at least have an idea of how to do things securely. It's just a matter of doing it. And so things like, I've been talking a lot about web browsers because that's something that used to be very vulnerable and now is much harder, still a little vulnerable, and something that I've personally done a lot of work on. But every time we move to something new, we see the same problem again. So like phones. When phones came out, smartphones that is, they were very vulnerable. Now they're getting better. Some research I just did recently with a colleague of mine named Chris Valsek, where we're looking at the security of computers and cars. You know, this is a very new field for them, and so they have the same kind of problems that a lot of software had 10 years ago. And I think this is going to continue, and there's been a lot of research in, you know, home you know, security systems. And every time there's a new technology, they have to learn the same lessons that we've been learning with computers for 10 years.
Let's talk a little bit about what you've been doing with cars, because as I mentioned in the introduction, I mentioned our automobiles. Explain to folks exactly what you're doing. I suspect most people don't realize how reliant new cars are on the computer technology.
Right. So I was sort of surprised myself. So I knew there was a computer in a car because there's a screen and it tells me how to get down to the studio or whatever. But it turns out that there's not one computer in your car. There's 20 or 30 computers in your car. And there's a computer that's in charge of your braking, a computer in charge of your steering, a computer in charge of your engine, a computer in charge of your seatbelts, and so on. And these computers all have to talk to each other. And it turns out the research that I've been doing is saying, well, suppose a bad guy somehow got code running on one of these computers. What could he do to your car? So like we know what happens if a bad guy gets on your computer. He, you know, can steal your pictures or your documents or whatever. But what can he do if he got in your car? And we showed, Chris and I showed a lot of pretty scary things, like you can make the car's brakes not work, or you can make the steering wheel, yank to the right or left. You can make the car accelerate and lock the door and do all sorts of crazy things. And so it's really interesting to me because, I've been doing computer security for a long time. But if I go to explain to my sister or my grandma what I do, they don't really understand what an exploit is against a web browser. But if I tell them I can make your car crash, then they know what I'm talking about.
Why, you know, I can't imagine why somebody would want to get into my car and make it go faster, unless it's just for the fun of it, some wacko weirdo out there doing that sort of thing.
Right. Yeah, I can't say why anyone would want to either, but I would like to drive a car that even if they wanted to, they couldn't do anything.
Are these things being fixed? I mean, as you discover them, you worked with Ford, did you not?
Well, working with is maybe not the right phrase, but I worked on a Ford and a Toyota. We reported all of our findings to those companies as well as the Society for Automotive Engineering. And, it's hard to say if they're working on it. Like it's not like a piece of software I can just download and check. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, a new car comes out and I don't have the money to just go buy all the cars and check them. So, we're really sort of at the mercy of the auto manufacturers.
While it's disturbing to hear this about cars and the fact that they are vulnerable to any, you know, person out there who wants to get involved, I'm thinking of trains and I'm thinking of airplanes. And, you know, they also rely on computers to a great deal. They're also vulnerable.
I haven't looked at those, but I wouldn't be surprised. Again, it's one of these things that it seems that manufacturers and groups and they don't think about security. And then their first instinct when someone like me brings up security is to say, no, that can't happen. Or, you know, don't worry, we're safe. And then once enough people like me have shown them that there's problems, then they start to think about fixing it. And I'd like to sort of short-circuit that and get us fixing things sooner rather than later.
Yeah, one of the things I worry about and looking at some of the material about you and the work that you're doing is I wonder if it's possible for a terrorist to bring down an airplane using computer technology.
I mean, the other thing – so, I mean, obviously that's happened without computer technology. And the same thing with cars. Like my car research is really cool, but if I wanted to crash your car, there's a lot of ways I could do it that doesn't involve computers. And so I think until – you know, if I'm a bad guy and I'm halfway smart, I'm going to choose the easiest way to do something. And at this point, most of the damage I can do is probably easier to do without computers. And that's going to change as things get more computerized. But for now, I think as a bad guy, I wouldn't worry about computers.
Yeah, the problem for the bad guy is if he wants to bring down a plane a la 9/11, he's going to be on the plane and he goes with it.
Right.
I'm talking about a way in which you know, they might find to disrupt the operation of the plane remotely.
Yeah, I mean it's certain. I mean, I would love to investigate that and see how vulnerable they are, and I'm afraid of what I would find.
Yeah, well, I wish somebody would hire you to do that. That's very very disturbing to think about some of these possibilities. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Charlie Miller in just a moment. As you've determined by now, I'm sure he is a professional hacker. We're calling him a cybersecurity researcher because that's what he does. He helps companies and organizations protect themselves from cyber hackers. Come back. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment. 382-8255 is the number. Come on in. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation with Charlie Miller. I'm going to take a call from Denver, Colorado, because we were just talking about security and automobiles, and I think Don in Denver wants to talk about that. Go ahead, Don.
Hey, everybody. This is Don Bailey from Denver. And Charlie, you and Chris Valasek did some excellent research on car security, and I was just curious to know if you guys were able to find any remote vectors into the CAN bus.
All right, so yeah, it's a great question.
Can I just ask for clarification? Remote, what was the last part of that question?
Yeah, I'll explain.
Okay.
So
Don
actually has done some good car research too. He's being shy, I think. But anyway, so the research that we did was we assumed, again, that an attacker had somehow got into one of the computers in your car. But we didn't talk about how they would get in your car, right? So we didn't do that part of the research, but previously some researchers from the University of Washington and the University of California, San Diego, had done that research. So they had shown that for, I think it was a 2010 Malibu, that through the Bluetooth connection in your car, the one that you used for, you know, like to dial your phone and stuff, they were able to actually get code running on your car remotely. So like from, say, 30 feet away, they could get stuff running on your car through the Bluetooth interface, and they could control your car that way. What Chris and I did was we said, okay, well, these guys have already done the remote part. So let's assume someone did the remote part. Then what can you do to the actual car? And that's when we showed, like, well, then you can control the steering or the brakes and that sort of thing.
Yeah. In one sense, I suppose you could make a case that maybe it would be good for the police to be able to stop somebody who was fleeing, but on the other hand,
I'd rather keep it to where no one can stop my car except me.
I would go the same way. Don, thank you. Thank you so much for the call. By the way, I should point out, as has been pointed out to me, that on our Facebook page, we have a picture of you working on, was it a Ford Focus?
Ford Escape.
Okay. Anyway, if you want to see Charlie in action in the car, you can go to our Facebook page, and you'll get to see a picture of that. Let's bring in a call from Chesterfield and Rick. Rick, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just curious if you suggest a virus protection program for a Mac.
Okay, so that's a great question. I've gotten that question for about the last 6 years, and I used to say no way, and now I'm starting to think that it might be worth it. So the question of whether you use antivirus is really a question of, you know, do you want to pay the money and have your computer, you know, using the some of its resources to run it, you know, versus the chance that it's actually going to protect you. And before, the scale was tipped where it wasn't really worth it. But now I think it's not going to – it's close enough of a toss-up that you might as well just get it if you're worried about it. I don't run it on my computer. But then again, I'm not sort of your typical computer user.
You know, you do a lot of work independently of companies, such as the case with the automobiles. Why do you do that? Just to let the companies know that they have this vulnerability, or just kind of a research project on your own?
It's just mostly for fun. So, you know, most people do crossword puzzles or watch TV or whatever. I like to hack stuff. So as far as what I choose to target, usually it's things I like. So I hack a lot of Apple things because I have an iPhone and I have a MacBook and I like those things. And so I'm around them a lot and I want them to be secure. So typically the things I hack are the things that I most like.
Well, you're persona non grata, at least you were with the Apple folks, were you not, for earlier work? Tell us about that.
Sure. Unfortunately, I'm still persona non grata with them. But yeah, it's sort of a long story. I've reported probably, I don't know, 50 vulnerabilities to Apple over the years, and they fixed them all. And so everyone's Apple products are more secure because of that. But one time they sort of didn't like my approach. I found this flaw in the way that apps from the App Store get on your phone that would allow them to download more code. So like this code that they could download might be bad. But part of the way that iPhones work is apps have to come from the App Store, and Apple has a chance to look at these. And so the only, you know, being from Missouri, the show me state, the only reason I could convince them, I knew that if I just said that there was a problem, they would say, no, we would catch that. And so the only way to know for sure was actually submit an app that then they approved that had the ability to download any code I wanted. And so I did that. And then when they found out about that, they got upset. And even though it didn't hurt anyone, and it had, you know, I pointed out the super important flaw that they fixed, they got mad and they told me, they kicked me out of the program that lets you write apps for at least a year, they said. And it's been closer to 2 years and they still haven't decided to let me back in.
How concerned should we be about the apps that are out there and downloading them?
Well, like I said, apps on your iPhone, they have to go through the App Store, and Apple at least has a chance to review them. Like, we have no idea how rigorous that approval process is, but at least it's something. On Android devices, there is a review process, but it's all automated. So we know about that, and I've actually done some research to show that there's easy ways to circumvent that. So apps are probably, if you're worried about smartphone security, downloading apps is probably the biggest threat for sure.
Is there anything we can do during that process? I mean, run an antivirus or something?
On iPhone, there's not really anything you can do because by design, everything goes through the App Store. You can't download software that can do things that antivirus can do. On Android, there's a lot you can do. So the best thing is to only use the official Google Play Store. Beyond that, in Android, when you get an app, it will tell you the things it can do. So that it'll ask for the certain permissions. And usually you just want to play the game or whatever and you click through that. But really it's important to look and see if it makes sense. So if you're downloading Tetris and it wants to be able to dial your phone, that's a big warning sign that you probably shouldn't accept that.
Yeah, well, we all have a tendency to punch accept or I agree to these various things without reading them.
Yeah, if you didn't want to play the game, you wouldn't have downloaded it. So
That's right.
You just want to hit the accept button.
I want to get going. On this very subject, Rich wants to become involved, so let's bring him in. Calling from St. Louis. Go ahead, Rich.
Hi, guys. This is Rich from St. Louis. Yeah, on that subject, I noticed on my Android when I download an app, you know, I'm getting things that are games that, like you said, they want access to my contacts and stuff, and even my bank application. And so I guess my question is twofold. One is, can we pretty much assume that anything we put on our phone these days is vulnerable and can get out? And second of question, part of that question is it pretty much a situation that if you want to download cool apps, you're not going to have any privacy, or vice versa?
Well, I think that I want to live in a world where I can download whatever app I want and feel safe about it, but that's not the world we live in. There's you should definitely pay. I'm glad you're looking at what the apps want, and you should decide, do I want the app to have that permission? How bad do I want to use this app? And just make your decision based on that. And so it's interesting to compare Android and iPhones, because it's a different design in that in Android, they let the users choose everything. So you're responsible for your own security in the sense that you get to pick what apps can do what. Where in iPhone, you don't ever have to do that because Apple decides for you. So there's good and bad for each of those. One is maybe a little more secure. Like, I don't mind making security decisions for myself, but I know a lot of people that I wouldn't feel comfortable letting them make security decisions for themselves. So it's probably not the best way.
Thanks for the call. We have a number of emails here. We'll go through some of these as time allows. What does Charlie think of hacktivism and the group Anonymous in particular?
So this is a group of guys who try to make statements and get back at companies and governments when they do things they don't like. And I agree with the points they're trying to make. We sort of share a lot of the same opinions on things, but probably can't say that I like that they're going out and breaking the law. Although they probably keep me employed, so I guess I should like that.
Well, some of them are paying a pretty hefty price for this kind of work. I mean, are likely to. I think of a guy like Snowden, for instance, and some of the WikiLeaks cases that have come up.
Sure.
They could spend a lot of time behind bars. Question from Elisa. Is there any way to tell good hackers from bad?
Is there any way to tell good people from bad people? No. I mean, the defining characteristic is basically if you're hurting people or trying to break the law. So I definitely steer clear of that because, like I mentioned earlier, I'm about 130 pounds. I don't think I would do well in prison. So I steer clear of that and try to protect people and help people as much as I can.
Let's take another call. Jack in St. Louis, go ahead. It's your turn.
Good morning. Hey, I want to ask you, Charlie, just what is your opinion on running wireless inside the firewall? There's so many people want to do that. And what is your opinion on how secure WPA2 actually is?
What is that? Let's clarify.
So that is the type of encryption used by a wireless network, or one type, I should say. So, it matters. Like, if you are running a business or a small enterprise or something, then the answer is probably going to be different than if it's just at your house. And like most things in security, it's always a trade-off between usability and security. So, like in my house, I run wireless, of course, and I actually I wouldn't recommend this for most people, but I actually don't even use encryption because I think that each of my systems should be secure whether there's a bad guy in the network or not. But most people, it makes sense to do that. I don't know. It's if it's just your house, it means that the attacker has to be, close by your house, and that's probably not going to happen very often unless you have a disgruntled neighbor. If you're a business, then it's, the stakes are a lot higher and you probably need to worry a lot more about security.
We have an interesting email here that strikes close to home to a lot of our listeners, I'm sure. As a frequent Schnucks customer, I was recently the victim of the widespread hacking there. Consequently, my bank canceled my old credit card, gave me a new account number. It's things like this that cause me to distrust so-called secure websites with personal financial information. Yet the same bank, as well as utility companies, are pressuring its customers to go paperless and do all transactions online. Many have instituted service charges to punish those of us who prefer the old-fashioned way. How secure are secure websites?
Right. I was a victim of Schnucks, too. I got a new credit card out of that.
So did we.
the tough thing about that is you don't necessarily know. Even I don't know when I use websites how secure they are because I can't see how they're set up. But the good thing about banks and Schnucks and credit cards in this case is that you're not financially liable for that. So even if the bad guys copied your credit card information and made a bunch of purchases, you'll notice you didn't have to pay for any of that. Your bank did. And so that's good for two reasons. One is that you don't have to pay. And the other is that the banks are very motivated to make sure that doesn't happen. because they know they're going to have to pay for it. So they do have pretty good security because they know that at the end they're going to have to foot the bill no matter what happens.
You say pretty good security. Pretty good is a step away from being absolute rock solid security. Is that ever possible?
Not really. You can make things extremely difficult, and that's really the way that the best you can really hope is to make things so hard that the attacker moves on and goes somewhere else. That's effective for almost everybody, unless you're, you know, the U.S. military or Barack Obama or something. Like, if you make it hard enough, the bad guys will find someone easier to attack, and that's really all you can hope for.
You know, I interviewed once a top burglar in this area who was responsible for hundreds of burglaries, and he said he didn't worry about security devices because anything that man made, he could circumvent.
Sure. Yep.
Same thing.
Yeah, absolutely the same thing. So, and that's kind of why it's fun to be a hacker, because someone who's pretty smart designed the stuff, and your job is to find a problem with it. And it's sort of adversarial in a way that is pretty rewarding.
It's a challenge.
Yeah, right.
You got to be competitive to do this.
Definitely.
Right?
Yeah. You have to think you're better than the guy who wrote the code.
Let's take a call from Pittsburgh. We're long distance calls today. Great, Chris, go ahead.
Yeah. Hi, Charlie. How are you doing this afternoon?
I think these are your pals, Charlie, right? Calling from out of town.
I can guess who this is.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I just wanted to know what percentage of people taking your car hacking code are going to be good guys, and what percentage do you think the bad guys are going to use?
So this is Chris Valsek, my partner in the car hacking, and also my internet best friend. So it's a good question, though. So one of the things we did with the car hacking was we released all our tools, all the details of how we did it, all the code, so that anyone else could do what we did. And that had sort of an inherent risk in that when you release that kind of information, like good guys like me can use it, and that's why we released it. But also a bad guy could use it. And so it's sort of the philosophy for us was, let's get this out in the open so we can have an informed discussion and fix things instead of hoping that manufacturers do it, which is what the previous researchers had never released any of the information. And so for us, it was important to get a lot of eyes on the problem and have a intelligent conversation.
We did a piece years ago in television showing how bad guys were breaking into the trunks of cars. And, of course, what we were also doing was teaching people how to break into the trunks of cars
exactly,
in the same process.
Exactly.
Yeah. One more call, I think. David in Defiance, you're going to be the last call, I believe, but it has to be quick. Go ahead.
Sure. Hello. Hey, my question has to do with hacking through the power supply of components like phones, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
So I'm assuming you mean like the USB connection. So there are some researchers this summer showed, for example, on an iPhone, if your iPhone is unlocked and you plug it into, you go to charge it into a station like maybe at the airport, that an attacker can download code and run it on your phone, so you could be vulnerable. So this is anytime you can get data of any kind, you know, whether it's through a USB connection or wirelessly, you're at risk.
You know, I read that you have said that with $49 million in a little time, you could take over the world or take over the world's computers. Can you tell me about that in a minute?
Not in a minute. So I took a little fun project, and if I was going to design a cyber army to attack the United States, how I would do it. And I just scoped it out and figured out how many people and how much money I would take, and those are the numbers I came up with. So it was just for fun to show what you could do, but I didn't actually do it.
Well thank you. What's the cyber army?
What was it?
Yeah,
it was a lot of guys like me sitting around and writing exploits and controlling lots of computers and attacking people. And I designed that back before Stuxnet, but I more or less laid out how Stuxnet would work. And I was just taking the idea of if I was the attacker, what would I do?
Right. And basically you're talking, I assume, and to a large degree, about disabling equipment, technology that could be used against you in this fight.
Sure. Like I said, the United States is extremely reliant on technology and our computers and the internet. And if you take that away, it's going to really affect things in a lot of ways that people probably can't imagine.
What's the best advice in 30 seconds you can give people about living in this cyber world of ours?
For just your personal computer, just be safe and don't download random things and only communicate with people you trust. Don't just go – I mean, the worst things on the internet are in the dark corners that only you visit. So if you just go to the most popular websites like NPR and – you just email with your friends, you're probably going to be okay.
Email or tweet.
Oh, yeah, tweet for sure.
Charlie Boyd, thanks so much for being with us. It's been a great pleasure meeting you and talking to you. It's a most fascinating discussion. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Join Jim Althoff tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about a concert to benefit the Scholarship Assistance Program of the University City Children's Center. And in the next installment of our Soundbite series produced with Sauce Magazine, he'll take a look at summer food reads, including cookbooks and culinary memoirs. He'll also hear an NPR feature with St. Louis Symphony music director David Robertson as part of the search for the great American symphony. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis On the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Camille Phillips, Jeremy Bailey, and Spencer Reed. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.